I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear the first part of a two-part speech given by Ellen Brown at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California, on May 16, 2010. She speaks about the financial 9/11. Ellen Brown developed her research skills as an attorney practicing civil litigation in Los Angeles. In her latest book, The Web of Debt, she turns those skills to an analysis of the Federal Reserve and the Money Trust. She shows how this private cartel has usurped the power to create money from the people themselves and how we the people can get it back. Brown developed an interest in the developing world and its problems while living abroad for 11 years in Kenya, Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. She returned to practicing law when she was asked to join the legal team of a popular Tijuana healer with an innovative cancer therapy, who was targeted by the chemotherapy industry in the 1990s. That experience produced her book Forbidden Medicine, which traces the suppression of natural health treatments to the same corrupting influences that have captured the money system. So here she is, Ellen Brown.
So anyway, I decided to cut out the historical part, so I'm just going to do that very quickly. The history of banking, how we got to where we are today, what the basic problem is, and where we need to go for a solution. So the problem is, for 300 years, or several thousand years, depending on if you want to go back to the Sumerians, but if you're just counting paper money, for 300 years, we've had two competing money systems vying for dominance. And one of them is publicly issued money, money issued by governments or by communities or by the people, and the other is privately issued money, money issued by banks and lent to the people. So today, the bankers have pretty much won. All of our money, except for coins, is created by banks in the form of loans. 99.99% of the M3 money supply is created by banks. It's all debt. Basically, there is no money in our system. It's all debt to bankers, and I'll explain how they create this. So the question is, how do we get out of that, or how do we reverse that? That's where they get their control. That's why the bankers own Congress, because they have the power to create our money supply. So we have to get that back, and how do we get that back? And that's what I want to address. But since this whole conference is all about 9/11 and controlled demolition and stuff, I wanted to talk about a controlled demolition that we're not so familiar with. It's another 9/11. September 11th, 2008 is one you may not have heard of so much. That was the day that Lehman Brothers got bombed in the stock market. Lehman Brothers actually went bankrupt on September 15th, but you can see that their stock collapsed on the 11th. It was heavily, heavily short-sold and naked short-sold. Naked short-selling is illegal, except by market makers. There's an exception for market makers, which I don't have time to explain, but basically the big market makers are the big rivals of Lehman Brothers, so it's like J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs. Naomi Klein calls it the shock doctrine, where we learned from 9/11 that a big shock to the system can be used to justify relinquishing individual rights or relinquishing sovereign rights, national rights. So Lehman was sent a shockwave around the world. It was considered a catalyzing event. After that, any banks too big to fail would be rescued, even at the expense of the taxpayers. I mean, we thought that the banks were bailing us out. In fact, of course, we're bailing the banks out, and we're the security for the banks rather than the reverse. So you might ask, what was so bad about Lehman? In fact, they were highly successful up until 2007. We know now that they actually were cooking the books the same as Enron was doing. I mean, they were in pretty bad shape, but they weren't really in worse shape than the other Wall Street banks. So why did they get targeted? According to their CEO, Richard Fult, they were the victim of rumors and of heavy naked short selling. And the SEC confirmed that there were as many as 32.8 million Lehman shares had been sold and not delivered. That means naked short selling, which was more than a 57-fold increase over the prior year's peak. That was by September 11th. So Short selling is where you sell a stock you don't own, and then you buy it back later. So you buy it back at a lower price, supposedly. I mean, you're assuming it's going to go down. So you sell it at one price, and you think you'll cover by buying it back at the lower price, and you keep the spread, the difference between what you sold it at and bought it back for. In naked short selling, you never buy it back. So there's just a lot of sales of shares of stock that you never really had. Another way that they were hit at that time was that J.P. Morgan and Citigroup were the big short-term lenders to Lehman Brothers, and they refused to lend without more collateral. And just recently, in March, the trustee in bankruptcy for Lehman Brothers said that Lehman actually had the collateral. I mean, they were actually over-collateralized, so that the shareholders actually would have a good claim against J.P. Morgan and Citigroup for demanding this extra collateral at that time. Now, you might wonder why it matters whether the other banks will lend to a bank. And that's what I'm going to get into, that the banks don't have the money. This whole system is, it's a shell game. And so they're all balancing this money created on their books and covered by borrowing from the other banks. So if the other banks won't lend to you, then you go down. They all need the support of each other to keep this whole shell game going. Now, we had the same thing happen with Bear Stearns in March. So, in fact, that was probably the first catalyzing event. Bear Stearns, too, had the collateral. And, in fact, they were bailed out by J.P. Morgan. Originally, the Federal Reserve was going to lend to Bear Stearns directly, and then they changed their mind, and they lent the money to J.P. Morgan to buy out Bear Stearns. So J.P. Morgan got the stock at $2 a share. Later, it was $10, but at $2 a share, it was down from $133. So effectively, it was called a bailout, but really, it was a hostile takeover. The shareholders got wiped out on this deal. And again, Bear Stearns actually had the money. In fact, it was Bear Stearns' collateral that was used for the loan that J.P. Morgan got the money from. So really, it was a bailout of J.P. Morgan. Ben Bernanke said that the Bear Stearns bailout was necessary to prevent a massive wave of cross defaults and chaotic unwinding of investments across U.S. markets. So you might wonder what that means, but that's the point, that it's this interwoven web of sleight of hand. There's nothing to it. There's no money behind it, except it's all debt to each other. I'll show how that works later. So over the whole summer, Bernanke, who's head of the Fed, and Henry Paulson, then head of the Treasury, were working for a bailout of the sort that we actually eventually got, the TARP bailout. But they couldn't interest Congress in it. The Congress just didn't think it was all that necessary. So what they needed was an economic 9/11, and that's what they got. And in fact, a year later, in the New York Times, there was this article, and the title was, Lehman Had to Die, It Seems, So Global Finance Could Live. So Lehman was actually sacrificed. It was the victim. And that's what the judge in the bankruptcy case said. Lehman Brothers became a victim, in effect, the only true icon to fall in a tsunami that has befallen the credit markets. You might wonder why one bank going bankrupt would have the effect of requiring every bank after that to be bailed out. Paul Kanjorski in February of last year was on C-SPAN, and this irate caller called in and said, where's my bailout? She said, I make under $10 an hour. I thought they were supposed to bail out the homeowners, and here we're bailing them out. And so Paul Kanjorski said, well, that was a misconception, that it was never about bailing out the homeowners, that what happened was this massive bombing of collapse of the money market funds. And that here's what he said then. On Thursday at about 11 o'clock in the morning, the Federal Reserve noticed a tremendous drawdown of money market accounts in the United States to the tune of $550 billion was being drawn out in a matter of an hour or two. That's like $500 billion. The Treasury opened up its window to help. It pumped $105 billion in the system and quickly realized that they could not stem the tide. We were having an electronic run on the banks. They decided to close the operation, close down the money accounts, and announce a guarantee of $250,000 per account so there wouldn't be further panic out there. If they had not done that, their estimation was that by 2 o'clock that afternoon, $5.5 trillion would have been drawn out of the money market system. That's like half the economy of the United States, would have collapsed the entire economy of the United States. And within 24 hours, the world economy would have collapsed. It would have been the end of our economic system and our political system as we know it. So supposedly that was why Henry Paulson fell to his knees, you know, begging for this bailout, that we absolutely had to have it. Now, the money markets are essential for businesses. That's where they, all businesses or most businesses do these very short-term loans where they borrow to meet their payrolls. And if they can't borrow from the money market short-term, then they have to close their doors. So businesses were having this crisis on their hands. The money market money is supposed to always be worth a dollar. I don't know if you've had a stockbroker and sometimes you have money in cash and he'll just put it in the money market. I mean, they don't even necessarily ask. The assumption is that the money market, a dollar is a dollar. You know, it's at least a dollar and you get a little tiny interest on that. But in fact, it fell to 97 cents the day that Lehman Brothers went bankrupt. And so there was a big run on a big money market fund. But that was on Monday. And then that fund closed down temporarily. That was the Reserve Primary Fund. And on Tuesday, AIG was bailed out by the Federal Reserve for $80 billion. And the stock market actually went up. And then it was on Thursday that we had this massive bombing of the money market. So you might wonder what happened on the 17th. It was like they hadn't done enough damage. The stock market was going back up. So they had to do something else. This is Marcy Kaptur. Democrat from Ohio.
Consent to address the House for 5 minutes and to include extraneous material in the record.
Without objection, so granted.
Mr. Speaker, here's the latest reality game. Let's play Wall Street bailout. Rule one, rush the decision. Time the game to fall in the week before Congress is set to adjourn and just 6 weeks before an historic election so your opponents will be preoccupied, pressured, distracted, and in a hurry. Rule two, disarm the public through fear. Warn that the entire global financial system will collapse and the world will fall into another Great Depression. Control the media enough to ensure that the public will not notice that this bailout will indebt them for generations, taking from them trillions of dollars they earned and deserve to keep. Rule three, control the playing field and set the rules. Hide from the public and most of the Congress just who is arranging this deal. Communicate with the public through leaks to media insiders. Limit any open congressional hearings. Communicate with Congress via private teleconferencing calls. Heighten political anxiety by contacting each political party separately. Treat members of Congress condescendingly, telling them that the matter is so complex that they must rely on those few insiders who really do know what's going on. Rule four, divert attention and keep people confused. Manage the news cycle so Congress and the public have no time to examine who destroyed the prudent banking system that served America so well for 60 years after the financial meltdown of the 1920s. Rule five, always keep in mind the goal is to privatize gains to a few and socialize losses to the many. For 30 years, in one financial scandal after another, Wall Street game masters have kept billions of dollars of their gains and shifted their losses to American taxpayers. Once this bailout is in place, the greed game will begin again. But I have a counter game. It's called Wall Street Reckoning. Congress shouldn't go home to campaign. It should put America's accounts in order.
She was good. I thought she was great. So what happened on the 17th was that there was another massive, massive bombing of the stock market with naked short sales. 23% of trades on the 17th were naked short sales and other failed trades. That means they were never covered. So somebody orchestrated that. That was done intentionally. And then you might also wonder why Ben Bernanke didn't just step in and say, well, we'll cover the money market funds. We'll guarantee them. But he said he didn't have the authority. But the funny thing was, a week later, after the TARP was passed, he did exactly that. He stepped in and said they were creating a special lending facility to buy commercial paper. So that was actually what stopped the bleeding, what prevented the market from collapsing, and not the $700 billion that Congress promised to the banks. So they got this, like Marcy Kaptur was saying, they got this quick money with no strings attached. So they got this bailout. So that was what the whole thing was about, was to get this sort of underwriting of the too big to fail banks with no strings attached. And this instilled fear that if we dared to not bail out any of the big banks, we would have the same near disaster that we had with the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the collapse of the money market. Now, another question was, where did the Federal Reserve get this $80 billion that they suddenly bought AIG with? AIG is a big insurance company, the world's biggest insurance company. But of course, the reason they were in trouble was not because of like auto insurance or house insurance. It was because they had gotten into derivatives. So that was the part that they needed to be bailed out from. So this is Nancy Pelosi. She too wanted to know where the money came from. She said, many of us were, shall we say, if not surprised, taken aback when the Fed had $80 billion to invest to put into AIG just out of the blue. All of a sudden, we wake up one morning and AIG has received $80 billion from the Fed. So, of course, we're saying, where's this money come from? Oh, we have it. And not only that, we have more. So it's a mystery, even to Congress, that the Fed can cough up this money at will. So there was a lawsuit brought by Bloomberg to find out where they got the money, who it went to, what the conditions were, and the Federal Reserve refused to say. They said that the documents were held by the New York Fed, which was not actually a public agency, and therefore it wasn't subject to Freedom of Information Act request, and that the suit involved protected trade secrets. So the question is, whose trade secrets and what secrets? We know it involved the banks. So the biggest secret of modern banking was revealed, and this is my favorite quote from Sir Josiah Stamp, governor of the Bank of England in the 20s. He said, "The modern banking system manufactures money out of nothing. The process is perhaps the most astounding piece of sleight of hand that was ever invented. Banking was conceived in inequity and born in sin. Bankers own the earth. Take it away from them, but leave them the power to create money, and with a flick of a pen, they will create enough money to buy it back again." There are many, many quotes, and you know, I had to cull down my quotes, but this is a good one from Robert B. Anderson, who was Treasury Secretary under Eisenhower. He said, "When a bank makes a loan, it simply adds to the borrower's deposit account in the bank by the amount of the loan. The money is not taken from anyone else's deposit. It was not previously paid into the bank by anyone. It's new money created by the bank for the use of the borrower." So it's done by double entry bookkeeping. So if you go to the bank and you want to buy a house, let's say, for $500,000, you'll sign a mortgage. And the bank will count that as an asset to themselves because you have promised to pay this money back over time. It's a negotiable instrument, a paying asset. So they write that on one side of their books as an asset. And on the other side of the books, they write the same $500,000 as a liability to themselves because they have promised to pay out if you write checks on that account. So at the bottom, it comes out to zero. So they say they haven't created anything. But that $500,000 that you're going to write checks on is what goes out into the economy and circulates as our money supply. So all of our money is like this, where it's all owed back to the bank, and the bank itself is on the hook for it. So it's a huge shell game where they're keeping all these balls in the air at once. Federal Reserve, in a booklet called Modern Money Mechanics, explained how this was done. There's a reserve requirement. The reserve requirement keeps dwindling, but it's supposed to be 10%. So that means the banks are supposed to hold back 10% of their deposits. Now, people think that the bank takes in deposits and lends that money. And in fact, that is what they used to do back in Jimmy Stewart, It's a Wonderful Life. That was where he got into trouble because he was taking the money of Mrs. Jones and lending it to Mr. Smith. But today, you never walk in the bank and they say, "I'm sorry, you'll have to come back in 30 years because we just lent your money to Mr. Smith." Your money is always there. So you can see from this chart, the original $10,000 in this chart that goes into the bank stays in the bank. You can see that $10,000 is always there. That's your deposit. And then the bank lends 90% of that. So they're not lending 90% of your money. They're lending a sum equal to 90% of your money. And then that money goes into another bank, or maybe your own bank, but anyway, it gets moved around from accounts. So say it goes into another bank, and then that bank counts it as a deposit, and it can lend 90% of that, and then 90% of that, and 90% of that. So this goes on about 20 times until your $10,000 becomes $100,000 in loans. Now, that's the conventional model, the textbook model. But that's not really how it works today. It looks more like this, where, in fact, when you go to the bank, say you're a business and you're a good client of the bank and they know that you're a creditworthy borrower. If one of their good clients, a corporate client, walks into the bank and wants a loan, they just give it. They don't check to see what they have in the way of deposits. They just write the loan into the account of their customer. And then when that customer writes checks on the account and the checks leave the bank, then they have to clear. So they usually clear through the Federal Reserve or some clearing agency. In fact, the Federal Reserve started clearing checks because in the 30s, when banks suddenly didn't trust each other, they wouldn't honor each other's checks because they knew that they probably didn't have the money, so they figured the other bank probably didn't have the money either. So the Federal Reserve set up this system where it would all clear through the Federal Reserve, and so then you knew that they had the money, and that's why you're supposed to keep this reserve over there in the Federal Reserve, although it's not real money that you put in the Federal Reserve. It's really just an accounting device. So you're supposed to have the same money coming in that you have going out. So you're supposed to have an equal number of deposits coming in as your checks going out. But if you don't have that, you, the bank, you can just borrow it from the other banks. And right now, the Fed funds rate is 0 to 0.25%. So they are borrowing from each other at almost nothing. They're almost getting this money for free. And you know the other banks will always have the money. In my little model here, say you have three banks and they each create $1,000 on their books as a loan and it goes out as a check into the next bank. So each one has $1,000 coming in and $1,000 going out. So their check's clear. It looks like they've got the money. But what they did was they just created $3,000 out of nothing. But it only works because they have each other to shift it around and backstop it. Yeah. But it's not a bad system. I mean, the only thing bad about it is it's private. But if it's public and you acknowledge that all we're doing is creating credit, that all of our money is basically you want the community to trust you to invest in your little business. So you go to the great computer in the sky, you know, the community lending facility, and you say, here's my business model and I'm going to pay this back doing this and this. And so you want the community to trust you with their credit while you employ workers and materials to build something, and then you'll pay it back out of the thing you produce. That's the basic model that has made America great, except for the fact that it's run through these private banks that are pretending to have the money and that are gouging us for interest for money that they didn't really have. Plus, they themselves are in trouble because it's a pyramid scheme. They always want more money back than they put out there because of the interest. So since borrowing is the only source of money in the system, they have to continually find more and more borrowers. This Ponzi scheme, it's essentially a pyramid scheme, has gone around the world until we've indebted everybody. And then it came back to us where they got into the housing bubble. And then when they ran out of good borrowers, they got into the subprime borrowers and then they wrapped it in derivatives. So it's all this desperate attempt to find more and more borrowers. It's a parasite and the parasite is running out of its food source. So it could work. I'll get to that. But it did work in Pennsylvania, Benjamin Franklin's Pennsylvania, when it was a publicly owned system. So today, all of our money, this is a M1, M2, M3, this is a chart of our money supply. All of it except this very tiny bit at the bottom is created by banks. The blue at the bottom is M1, which is what you normally think of as money, which is coins, paper dollar bills, and checkbook money. Well, paper dollar bills are already created by the Federal Reserve and lent to other banks, which then lend them to the government and to us. So they are borrowed into existence and they are owed back. The only thing that's not owed back to somebody is coins, which is just a very marginal bit. And all this other stuff isn't even paper. It's just accounting entry money that's been created on the books of banks. So it's all a confidence trick, and it depends on confidence to work. So the way the banks maintain this confidence is in 1913, they set up the Federal Reserve to backstop a collapse or to backstop bank runs when people would periodically figure out that the banks didn't have the gold. That was when we were on the gold standard. Or the other alternative is bailouts like we've got today. Nobody even thinks we're on a gold standard anymore. And the Federal Reserve itself wasn't sufficient. So now we've got taxpayer bailouts. So Wall Street has gotten a huge amount of money out of the deal. Originally it was $700 billion. It quickly went to $800 billion with pork. By the summer of last year, loans, commitments, and guarantees were $24 trillion. And I saw recently that actual payouts were $4.6 So getting back to the conspiracy theory, I'm afraid I'm going to have to leave a bunch of stuff out of it. I mean, there's so many interesting ramifications of this, but I want to follow through on what happened to Lehman Brothers. Who pushed Lehman Brothers over the cliff without a parachute? It could have been J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, the other banks that obviously profited hugely from this bailout. But there is another set of players here, and those are the actual rivals of Wall Street itself, which would be the City of London and the old European bankers. Over the weekend, Lehman Brothers was in negotiations to be bought out by Barclays Bank. Well, first of all, of course, the Fed and the Treasury, or that would be Paulson and Bernanke, refused to bail out Lehman. They had just bailed out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and they knew they were going to have to bail out AIG. So they refused to bail out Lehman because they said, well, we can't bail out everybody. And so Barclays Bank was in negotiations. But the Fed wouldn't agree to guarantee the loan. And at the last minute on Sunday, Alistair Darling, who was basically the treasurer in England under Gordon Brown, said, no, we're not going to approve that because you have to have shareholder approval and there hasn't been time for shareholder approval. I mean, that was a reasonable thing to say. But the thing is, it was at the last minute when there was no other alternative but to put it into bankruptcy. So you could argue that the British did it. I mean, we're not sure who did it, but it could have been the British. And interestingly, Darling also could have saved Northern Rock and didn't. And Northern Rock was the catalyzing event in England a year earlier, almost on September 11th. It was actually September 12th that the Bank of England refused to extend credit to Northern Rock. And then on the 13th, we had this massive bank run, which was the first bank run they had had for 141 years. And then finally, the Bank of England said, okay, we will extend credit to you and everybody else. We could see what was going to happen. There were going to be massive bank runs unless they had a bailout of the banking system. And so that they've been bailing them out ever since, just as we have. And what Alistair Darling had to do with that was that as the treasurer acting on behalf of the government, they actually own the Bank of England, unlike our Federal Reserve, which is not owned by the government, but is owned privately by a consortium of banks. So the government could have ordered the bank to bail out Northern Rock, but they didn't. And the reason was apparently that Gordon Brown had been instrumental in making the Bank of England independent in the 90s. He was credited with that, so they were preserving his policy. Now, Gordon Brown himself has often called for a new global financial order. In 2007, he called for a new world order reforming the UN, the World Bank, the IMF, and the G7. At the G20 conference in October of 2008, he called for a new Bretton Woods creating global governance. And in 2009, sometimes it takes a crisis for people to agree that what is obvious and should have been done years ago can no longer be postponed. It's shock therapy. We must create a new international financial architecture for the global age. The threats and challenges we face today are the difficult birth pangs of a new global order. Well, it's just such odd language. You would never talk about a new global order. Like, don't worry, it's just the new global order. It's language you would not use unless you had routinely gone to meetings, secret meetings or private meetings, where people are talking about the new world order and that this is what we're tending toward and this is what we're trying to do here. And we have the famous Rockefeller statements that are quite similar. In 1994, David Rockefeller said, we are on the verge of a global transformation. All we need is the right major crisis, and the nations will accept the new world order. And then in his memoirs in 2002, he said, some even believe we are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure. If that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I'm proud of it. I mean, they actually believe in this stuff, that the New World Order is a good idea.
You've just been listening to the first part of a speech given by Ellen Brown at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California, on May 16th, 2010. Tune in next week to hear the second and final part of her speech. And to learn more about Ellen Brown or to order her book, Web of Debt, her website is webofdebt.com. You can also see the video of this speech by going to the website understandingdeeppolitics.org. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.